Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Lee Fulkerson, a series of podcasts from Plant Pure Nation. I'm Lee Fulkerson, and my guest today is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. He has been at the forefront of nutrition research for over 40 years. His legacy, the China Project, is the most comprehensive study of health and nutrition ever conducted. He is a professor emeritus at Cornell University and also co-authored the best-selling book, The China Study, with his son, Thomas Campbell, MD. So welcome aboard, Dr. Campbell. It's great to have you.
Pleasure to be here, Lee.
Okay, so first off, in your recent book, Whole, you assert that academia plays a major role in the promotion of science that's biased towards the food and drug industry. Why do you say that?
Well, it seems that the more simplistic way of thinking about biological things, quite frankly for decades, if not longer, has been to focus on what I call magic bullets. A lot of people know that concept. We tend to want to believe that the causes of disease and ailments might be narrowed down to some very specific agents, and oftentimes they can be. That's not in doubt for some cases. But then, in addition, we also think that at the other end, when these problems are occurring, the antidote to solving these problems, especially on complex type of diseases, the answer is going to also be, you know, to find some specific agent that's targeted to some specific site, you know, that's problematic. And so on both ends, starting with disease, ending with disease, we tend to focus on just using one thing that we can identify, maybe by chemical structure, maybe by function, some other ways. And that's just kind of a simplistic, maybe it's a natural way to think, but it's a very simplistic way to think when in reality biology doesn't work quite that way. So we get into difficulty when you seem like to me when we use one thing to solve some very complex problem, that's going to end up with, and we know this, with missing the mark, possibly, or at least, you know, offending all the rest of the environment surrounding that target. So we get side effects. Side effects are common. All we need to do is watch the television when those ads come on.
And so what is the role of academia in furthering this mistaken paradigm?
Well, they suffer, of course, the same kind of thinking, I guess, to some extent, but probably in more recent years, and I'm talking about the last half century, when research became a big object for academicians, big universities wanted their faculty to do research, in part, to bring in some money. That really started in earnest in the late 50s, early 60s, when NIH became more prominent. And so there was some money there to be had. And so a lot of people started doing research in the academic arena on their topics of particular interest to them. And that money actually coming from NIH and all its various institutes the money comes as a result of competition amongst researchers, putting up an idea, submitting an application, getting it reviewed. And the more focused the hypothesis really was, the more likely it was to get funded. It was easier to review, and you could see more or less the construction of the study and so forth. Mm-hmm. I've sat on a number of those panels, even chaired them. And so I think that element was there, that researchers did that. And so they fell into a trap too. I mean, they almost to survive in academia eventually in the 60s and 70s, we had to do research, at least in biomedical sciences. If we didn't do the research and we didn't get it published and weren't successful in raising money and we didn't yet have tenure, that was usually a ticket out the door. And I sit on those committees too. I've seen that work.
Mm-hmm.
And so academicians have focused a lot on, you know, doing specific things. And, you know, maybe, I mean, some of that kind of research is good. It's as long as there's parts of a whole and it helps us to understand the whole, then it's fine. But unfortunately, when it's done in isolation and in a way in which products are produced, you know, for big solutions, we get into trouble, as I mentioned before. And so academicians are part of the problem. And it's gotten worse. It's really gotten worse over the years. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to ask, why is academia's role worse than that played by industry, government, the medical establishment, the pharmaceutical companies, et cetera?
Well, not to defend those other groups, you know, quite frankly. Nonetheless, I just to speak to objective as I can about it. I understand what industry is about.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to meet the bottom line, and they're serving shareholders and so forth. I just understand what they're doing. Not that I accept a lot of what they're doing, but I do understand it. So I give them a pass to some extent. On government, in that particular case, government now, government policy at least, is largely influenced, in fact, in many ways, even controlled by corporate interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so when expert panels get together to deal with a particular kind of question of public interest, the members of the panel are generally carefully selected. And unfortunately, more and more, there's corporate bias on these panels. In other words, people are selected who are likely to adhere to the party line, if you will, party line being to support of the industry, if you will. And I sit on those panels myself, and I can saw that firsthand. And so I give a pass on government to some extent. And these days, the officials in government are bought and sold, essentially, you know, with the resources coming from the same place. So it's quite frankly, it's a mess in my view. It's really quite seriously corrupted. So the people serving on those panels, incidentally, are academicians for the most part, as they have been in the past. And then you can talk maybe about the medical practitioner group, you know, doctors, if you will. Well, they are taught, you know, in a very reductionist way, you know, to use specific drugs or antidotes to solve problems. And that's part of their problem. And so the physicians are operating in a state of ignorance about, you know, better ways to think about this. When I say better ways, I'm talking about, you know, solutions that are much more holistic. Unfortunately, they tend not to make money, and therein lies a problem. They're not targeted, and that's the hallmark of the pharmaceutical industry. So to some extent, I give the medical practitioners a pass, too, because it's really ignorance. They're not taught
right. This.
So we have corporate interests. We have government interests, medical practitioner interests, the media. I can't quite give them the same pass. They ought to have the opportunity to at least freelance people to write what they want to write. And a lot of them do. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh on that. But quite frankly, they have to sell their story.
Yeah.
Newspapers, in turn, have to, you know, serve their readers. And the most readers, the better. More readers, the better. And so that institution of media institution, they're largely controlled, too. So here we got four big institutions sort of operating under the same umbrella, all focused on reductionist ideas, magic bullet ideas, and that's where the money is. So I come back to academia, and I ask myself, well, what about academia? What's the role? And therein, I just find that, for what I said before, academia has a responsibility, in my view, at least as perceived responsibility, that's what the public believes.
Yeah.
They have a responsibility to essentially tell the truth.
To be objective.
Exactly. Be objective and be venturesome a little bit. That's what the whole idea is all about. And try some new ideas and not be fearful of you know, not having the funding to do the work or be fearful of maybe not getting tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're constrained. Obviously, there's very large forces, very personal, very large forces at play, which has unfortunately gotten worse. But still, among the active missions who do have the tenure, on tenure, not so much on tenure tracks, but the ones who already have tenure, they have to have, in my view, they ought to be having a responsibility to tell the truth. And unfortunately, too many of them are not. I think the vast majority of them are really good people, working hard. Mm-hmm. They chose that for their lives. And so they're doing research of interest, and they're being objective and truthful as much as they can, given the circumstances. But now these days, those kind of people, they only make up 30% of the total faculty, whereas it used to be close to 80 to 90%. And so only 30% of the faculty, as of 2010, only 30% of the faculty are, on tenure track positions, don't even necessarily have tenure yet. And so that number of people who are theoretically in that category of having tenure and being willing to speak and have the freedom to speak, that number is really dwindling, and it's dwindling fast. And so the rest of the academicians, they're interested in keeping their job. Not only that, they're just interested in at least having the opportunity to participate in their discovery. And that's what they want to do. But they know where the boundaries are. They know what they can say and what they can't say, even though they may not talk about it very much. In fact, now what I'm finding is we can't even, in some cases, get a good symposium going. Symposium, I mean by that, airing different points of view. Let's say in a meeting, having three or four speakers or so. I used to organize some of those myself. I participated many years ago. It's difficult now because the topics chosen for a symposium are the ones that are most interest to the, to people supporting them, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just see you almost have to be inside of the system to see how serious this is. I mean, I feel really badly about it because the public tend to assume, much less these days than they used to, but the perception was academia was the place where you could go and you'd get objective answers, when in fact that's much less likely now than it was before. Just in my lifetime, I've seen these big differences. I've lived it.
It's tragic.
So,
a
long answer. But,
No. It's a great answer. Very informative, and especially given your long familiarity with this topic. And speaking of that, I want to talk about the an example of this bias. Specifically, it's the one linked to the Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Committee that you served on in the early 1980s. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, there were several. I could cite several topics coming out of that report to illustrate the point. Maybe I'll talk about dietary fat,
mm-hmm.
possibly. Until 1980, when that report was organized, that committee was organized, there was a fairly widespread belief that the fat content of the diet was the principal offender of the problems we had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of focus on how much fat should we consume. And the amount of fat in the diet is usually best expressed, as a percent of total calories. Fat, of course, does supply calories, and so it's a percent of the total calories. And at that time, the average American diet was around 35 to 40% fat. Pretty high.
That does.
And that was associated with heart disease, especially, according to some work done in the 50s and 60s and 70s at that time. It's just associated primarily, and so we were advised to give some recommendations on how much fat to consume and not consume. And as a committee, there were 13 of us, we settled on the number of 30% we could get it down to 30%, we thought that was kind of a practical target. It wasn't, that's not what the evidence really suggested. The evidence suggested something lower than that. And I remember I was just probably the most vigorous one on the committee arguing, we got to set it lower. And I learned then that, no, we can't go below 30% fat, because if we do that, it's going to begin to question the foods that are thought to be having the most fat, namely animal foods. And that would cause us to decrease the consumption of this really valuable nutrient called protein. So we got down to the 30% figure, and we let that sit. But they agreed on the rest of the committee to put a clause in there. It said to the effect in the executive summary, we said 30% fat, even though the data suggests something lower. That was the compromise that I kind of settled on too, because I also thought it was important to get this message out to the public. And at that time, there was really almost nothing official coming out about a possible relationship between diet and cancer. Diet and heart disease, yes, focused on fat primarily, but not cancer. So it was all that idea, just focused on fat as the culprit. And over the years, I think we now have really good data to show why that was false. It's true that we should consume low-fat diets, but we should do so by not using a lot of added oils and stuff like that, which are rather offensive, we know now. As far as getting if we just use whole foods, then we don't need to worry too much about the fat. In fact, as a matter of fact, it's the total diet that actually creates the good responses and bad responses, if you will. And that brings up the question, well, which kind of foods, you know, should be part of that diet? And that answer, I think, is a whole food plant-based diet, of course. And in that kind of diet, if you don't add back added oil and stuff like that, you can get down to 10%. You know, far below the 35 to 40%, you get down to 10%. Mm-hmm. It can range higher a bit if it's in the form of whole food, but that's quite a change. And so the real question then eventually evolves into a discussion about the effect of the fat content of the diet. If it should be around 10% or so, the only way one can really get there is not mm-hmm. using animal foods, and also not using added oils. But as I say, there can be some variation in that 10% figure. I don't see anything wrong with getting around 15%, maybe mm-hmm. on occasion, you know, 20%, something like that. What I'm really referring to is using foods like nuts and avocados and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which, as long as it's whole foods, okay. So there was an argument about fat. Well, everything focused on fat. And the entire argument and discussion occurred without ever giving too much consideration, not in a positive way, of what the rest of the food looked like, the diet looked like. We could go on and on about this. I could talk about cholesterol as well, which has been a really sad mistake that's 100 years old. Mm-hmm. But let me mention just the vitamin supplement thing.
Yeah.
On that question, you know, we had discussions in the book on vitamins, individual nutrients, of course, just for the sake of convenience, to discuss the data. But at the end of the report, we ended up talking about consuming fruits and vegetables and grains, and we said, let's bring all these ideas together. We're talking about whole foods, and we specifically said in the executive summary that our discussion about the individual nutrients did not imply that this meant nutrient supplements. This was 1982, we said that, when the industry for nutrient supplements was kind of small, but we knew there were significant people interested. I mean, people had significant interest in that possibility. Well, our report came out, and we carefully said in the summary, this does not mean nutrient supplements, but instead what happened was some young, enterprising, well, not certain young, but some enterprising entrepreneurs got together and said, took out ads in the major magazines like Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report, saying that our report was endorsing the consumption of more of this kind of nutrient and that one and so forth. And what they were really doing was build the case for nutrient supplements. Of course, our report said nothing of the kind. But there was money there. Mm-hmm. And I saw that whole operation because the Academy actually asked me to represent them as the so-called star witness, is what they called it, in some Federal Trade Commission hearings on health claims. And I spent 3 years sitting in the docket, more or less, talking about or, you know, evaluating the claims that they were making and the science behind it. And it was my opinion, and I know my colleagues more or less agreed to the same thing, that we're not talking about nutrient supplements. But the industry said, and the case was won on that ground, on those grounds, essentially. But the industry didn't give a hoot. They kept pushing ahead, and they got some new legislation passed, and the so-called Dietary Supplement Health and Supplement Act, DSHEA was the acronym. That was passed in the middle 90s, and so they did everything they could to make to pave the way to have a nutrient supplement industry. And it took off like a shot. And
how big is that industry now? It's over $30 billion or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's latest I heard, and this, gosh, this is probably, I think, about 5 years old now. It's somewhere around $30 to $35 billion a year.
Wow.
I mean, this is not small potatoes. This is a big deal. And a lot of, pardon?
I'm sorry, isn't it true that part of that legislation they got passed was to identify nutrient supplements not as drugs but as foods?
Correct. Absolutely. That was our intent, and that makes it comes across at times, but still, the industry, who has a free reign to advertise their stuff, it seems to me, and the present system, and so everybody started believing that nutrient supplements was the answer. They didn't need to change their diet, just, you know, amend it.
Yeah, by taking these supplements.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, in those cases, we now have evidence, because now there's been research done on that. When a supplement is consumed, and we ask the question, you know, what effect does that have on this or that disease? And we're seeing quite a number of cases now when supplements are consumed, instead of reducing disease risk, for which the claims, you know, meant, it actually increased risk significantly in quite a number of studies.
Wasn't there something about beta carotene and
beta carotene
lung cancer?
Exactly. That one, that was a study of about 8 years duration, a joint study between the United States and Finland. And there the hypothesis was that people, smokers especially, because smokers get their lung cancer in large measure because of the excessive oxidation going on in their lungs, for starters,
mm-hmm.
which tends to promote cancer. But in any case, so the idea came out, a review in 1981 by a friend of mine, it's Richard Pito and Richard Dahl, they and some colleagues, they showed in a total of 22 studies that when it compared the consumption of beta-carotene, for example, with respect to lung cancer, I think it was 20 out of the 22 studies showed that the higher the consumption of beta-carotene, the lower was lung cancer risk. So there they had some information to suggest that beta-carotene is good stuff. But
mm-hmm.
in that particular case, they focused on beta-carotene because it sort of made sense. It was an antioxidant, and smoking damage was caused by pro-oxidation. So they did the study, and what they found at the end of the 8 years, had to cut it off earlier than intended because the lung cancer was higher in those taking supplements, even though it was lower in those who were getting it from food.
So it was that's amazing, and it was considerably higher, wasn't it? It was a huge increase, so and that's why they actually terminated the study earlier.
Yeah, considering the number of people who would be so affected, it was, as I recall, 46% increase.
Wow,
which was highly significant, and that indeed was repeated in another study about that time too. So it was convincing. That was the point. It was really convincing. And So
okay, that's amazing. So what about the increasing role of food and drug companies in funding scientific research on college campuses? Could you speak about that for a little bit?
Well, the food and drug companies, of course, they do want to fund research from time to time. And obviously people aren't, and actually they aren't getting money to, you know, get it from the public still. You know, they will accept money from industry.
Mm-hmm.
And although these researchers are generally intending to be forthright, objective, honest, all that sort of thing, the way the system is built, they can't, unfortunately, be entirely objective, it seems to me, because when we're doing research of this kind and, you know, you got a body of data to look at, and let's say it goes against the grain, what was intended.
Mm-hmm.
And too often, that kind of information tends not to get published. So it's sort of the absence of publishing negative data that is part
mm-hmm.
of the problem. And nobody ever needs to know about it. It's not so much the presence of publishing bad data. It's actually the problem of not publishing data that's more informative, that, you know, is not supportive of the hypothesis or the interest. So if they were to publish something like that, example in case in point, Hoffman Roche at that time was producing about 60 to 70% of all the vitamin C supplements in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were anxious to give some funding support. And if somebody came along and showed that vitamin C in excess amounts could be a problem, they would tend not to publish that, because if they published that, I don't think they would expect to get any more support in the next round.
Right.
So,
not only would they not get their research published, but then they wouldn't get any follow-on funding for more research. So they'd
exactly.
be kind of like, get the door slammed in their face.
Exactly. It's just that bias exists. There's no question about that. And it can be pretty serious. But we don't see it. We don't see that kind of bias very much. The public doesn't get to see that. What
people tend
to talk about is, you know, who manipulated data or something of that sort, which also goes mm-hmm. on too, but sometimes.
Yeah. So can, and it's all, behind the curtain of academia again.
Yeah,
which,
it is.
People, you know, just assume that those people in academia are going to be unbiased and, as you say, seek the truth. And it's really sad that this has changed for the worse. So could you tell us about some of the changes you've seen on the Cornell campus that are linked to the food industry influence? I mean, some of them, I think, are actually really funny.
Yeah, some of those things that I've seen are hideous and extremely annoying. The question concerning dairy and the influence of dairy, which is generally sold to the American public because it's a good source of calcium, it's a
mm-hmm.
good source of protein. I mean, that's been around for a long time. And so they win the day, and they've convinced the public of that. Of course, we now know that the higher the consumption of calcium, the higher is the risk for osteoporosis, not the reverse. But nobody wants to say that. The dairy industry doesn't want to say that. And that's been around since, for 30 years. So the dairy industry continues to, you know, work its magic. And they oftentimes will have their own sort of dairy offices on campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And some faculty member will be there with maybe some funding to steer to people who will do the kind of research that dairy industry wants. But that's a little more direct. But the dairy industry also is tightly coupled with the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA. So the USDA, in turn, tends to be a livestock-oriented agriculture agency that's evolved over two decades, actually. They look out more for the raising of livestock, including dairy, than they do growing carrots. And so USDA, they have a doorway into academia. It's been in existence since the days of President Lincoln,
mm-hmm.
at a time when land-grant colleges were first set up. And there was obviously an interest, good interest at that time, to have these land-grant colleges in agricultural areas, pay attention to the food being produced and so forth. And so there was enough be enough food for everybody to have. And much of that was became an entitlement program that grew in money. And so still today we have entitlement programs where money coming from the USDA is paid to land grant schools.
Uh-huh.
And that money is there might be a few exceptions on smaller amounts of money, but in broad context, that money is when it comes from USDA is intended to basically be supportive of livestock industry, including the dairy industry. That kind of money is quite substantial.
Isn't there on campus, there is this sort of like big metal edifice. It's sort of like a gateway that's shaped like a milk bottle or something like that. Could you describe that for me?
Yeah. When I was a student at Cornell, my office is in the Dairy Science Building. And
mm-hmm.
I thought that was fine. I never raised any questions at that time. A nice old building, and I was doing my research and so forth and so on. I was also attending a lecture upstairs, a big auditorium. And in any case, that lasted. I felt kind of smug a bit because I was given the desk of the Nobel laureate who had just passed away before I came there. So he had his desk, and that was kind of neat. In any case, I took classes in the big auditorium upstairs in the building just over my office and stuff like that. And there was a dairy cafeteria in there, and it was all fine and dandy. And in any case, as my career unfolded over the years, I wasn't in that office, I was elsewhere on the campus, but as that unfolded, I obviously ran across this information that dairy protein was a problem. So I started publishing that and getting more and more trouble as time passed, and then I started getting in real serious trouble, when they didn't want my class to continue. But along about the same time, now about a year ago, I think it is, I hit where that building that I was sitting in was went over a major rehaul, and the old part of the building sort of still stands with renovation. And there's a newer part, all glass, very fancy. $106 million is the figure I've seen that they put into that building.
Wow!
And it's a monument to the dairy industry as far as I'm concerned. And they showcase it because outside there's about a 20-foot glass monument in the shape of a milk carton so everybody could see it. And then that's one thing. And then that auditorium that I just spoke about a moment ago, I also found that really offensive because that auditorium, a lot of memories I have there and stuff like that, but now it's a fancy big auditorium and the name of the auditorium is called PepsiCo Auditorium.
Oh my God.
Which I think is just disgusting. The presence of the dairy industry on the campus is just overwhelming.
I have actually seen pictures of this big metal edifice that looks like a milk bottle. I mean, it looks kind of like the entrance to a dairy theme park or something like that.
Yes, it is. That's right. That's exactly right. We have a Dairy Queen contest here in New York, by the way, at the annual fair, agriculture fair. And Cornell is deeply involved in that fair. It has been in the past. And so we have a Dairy Queen. Makes lots of news,
right? Dairy Queen. I love it, right on campus. There's probably, you just see in that dairy theme park, it's a roller coaster where you don't get ducked in, water at the end, but you go through a puddle of milk or something like that.
That's about right.
In conclusion here, what are your concerns or hopes for the future of this issue about the compromisation of academia?
Well, the main thing I think about is the fact that the public doesn't know this information. That's clear, and everybody can agree to that. They don't know the information, so therefore, the question then becomes, how does the public get informed? When I started thinking about that question and having just written or I'm about to publish a history that goes back to 1646 that I wrote when I was at Oxford 30 years ago. But in any case, knowing that history, seeing how all this information unfolded, the one thing I do want to say from that is that the public is not informed because of this overwhelming presence of the industry and what the public gets to know. Knowledge is power. I love that statement.
Yeah.
It was however many millennia ago that was said. But knowledge is power. Boy, I see that in spades. Knowledge is power. So what has really happened in subtle ways sometimes, but very insidious in ways through the decades, the industry knows that they want to control the source of knowledge. And boy, have they done that big time. And so, and it's a very proactive kind of activity. I mean, the government, for example, will do that. Certainly the industry does when they're advertising products too. They want to shape the knowledge, the public knowledge mm-hmm. base. And in the process, they don't want to teach nutrition in medical schools because that would upset the apple cart. And they want to speak of nutrition when they do and if they do in a very negative way. And so the public has for decades been swimming in this pool of ignorance. It's a swamp. And mm-hmm. they don't have a clue about some of the stuff that we now are learning. And they're so fixated in the public mindset that you come along and say some things that I tend to say, you know, people are going to think maybe they want to lock you up or something. And so that's just the way it is. And so I talk about the future, knowing that, and I say that's a really key problem. The issue then is, well, how do you inform the public? Well, there's various ways we can try to get nutrition training to medical school, so we have a program, you know, wanted to do that. Another way is to get communities involved, you know, and becoming aware of this and choosing and having access to foods that they might like and so forth. I think the Plant Pure Nation project, you know, embodies those ideas really beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, first the food is available, it's affordable, it's tasty, you know, we know what it does. You know, let communities sort of take that idea and try it here. We'll try it ourselves. They can see for themselves. And the
yeah.
fact that there's, you know, a network of these pods, you know, they're growing, I hope. You know, they and the concept for that is, I think, really attractive because it's organized in such a way that pods are not competing with each other, which is a great
mm-hmm.
thing. We have too much competition in our society. I think they're encouraged to look at their neighbors as sort of to cooperate with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can maintain their own identity and their own purpose, whether it be environmental or animal rights or whatever they choose to, you know, center their interests on. But they all think that the plant-based diet is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, to me, that kind of environment enables and encourages, I think, cooperation rather than competition. So I can say a lot of good things about that, and that's, to me, in a broad context, is one way to, you know, on the ground, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
getting people to hear about this and try the food. Let's try the food. And there it is. And so we got then movies. I have to say that, Lee. You know, films, obviously, I know is one tool. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
And you, of course, you know, involved in the making the Forks Over Knives and involved in Plant Pure Nation, that's another very special tool that has an effect too, without a doubt. Books, you know, books can happen.
Yeah.
And so we got all these tools, and it's all to, I'd like to look at. I think all those tools we can say, I believe, we're trying to inform the public.
Absolutely.
And that's what the public has not been. They've not been provided that opportunity in the past.
That's really tragic.
And so, whatever.
It almost seems like you know, with the money and all the forces that are lined up on the other side, it almost seems like the idea of academia ever freeing itself from that influence is sort of a lost cause. Do you think that that's the case, or do you think there's any chance of redemption there?
Boy, what a terrific question. I would hate to say it's a lost cause, but on the other hand, it's still looking at a larger context. It seems like to me a country that claims to be free,
mm-hmm.
claims to be democratic. You know, there ought to be some islands in that society where you really do enjoy and you practice the concept of freedom. You can have the discussions and it can be public and they can be transparent and you can agree to disagree, and all those beautiful ideas about that kind of dialogue. We need to have those kinds of venues in our society where people are truly free to study, think, you know, discuss. That's academia. That's the way I look at it. Maybe it's always simplistic. But I think these are the pillars almost of a free society.
Yes.
And yank those pillars out. It seems to me we're only a short step away from being a society that's totally controlled. And so I couldn't have more passion for the idea that we need academies, you know, where this kind of thing takes place. And I'd say, damn it, that's just been corrupted. It's just beyond me that, you know, I've seen it just in my short time on this earth to see that kind of change occurring. And so somehow needs to be brought to the attention of the public.
It's really disheartening, and I hope that this interview will help to sort of correct the record and at least alert people to this issue. And, you know, who knows, maybe people can bring pressure to do something about it. I don't know. But it really is, I think, very, very troubling that academia has been influenced and corrupted in this way. It should be a bastion of free thought and the untrammeled exploration of ideas and all of those things. And, you know, where there are no wrong questions that you can ask, you know, you just need to investigate them objectively and come up with the right answers. So anyway, I really appreciate your insight into this issue. It's unique and very obviously comes from a lot of personal experience and close observation. So I thank you for your time. This has been great, and I'm sure we'll talk again about other issues, but I think this one is really, really important.
Well, thank you so much. It's great.
Okay. Take care, doctor.